Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the July issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Come to Life in Colorado. Come to Life is one of the state's slogans. And when she moved there years ago, that's exactly what she did. Now, our Colorado correspondent talks with other Coloradans about what they love about the Centennial State. By Wendy Wilkinson. When I moved from crowded and congested West Los Angeles to the small artist community of Manitou Springs at the foot of Pikes Peak in Colorado, it marked a big lifestyle change. It meant not just a return to the equestrian life, but the opportunity to really live, to come alive, as the state slogan goes. My parents had bought me my first horse at the age of 10, when we were living in Hidden Hills, now home to the Kardashian clan, and I have owned and ridden horses ever since those days in the Santa Monica Mountains. But riding a horse in Colorado was unlike anything I'd experienced in California. Soon after arriving, horseless, in Colorado in 1997, my friend and sometimes client for publicity projects, William Devane, who had gifted me with an Arabian horse more than two decades earlier in L.A., decided that my husband and I needed horses in Colorado as well. Much to my delight, Devane, who is not just a famed actor but also an equine enthusiast and polo aficionado, bestowed on me two beautiful retired thoroughbred polo ponies. Emmylou and Adrian made the trek from his polo farm near Palm Springs to Manitou Springs, where their new home was a riding stables and boarding facility that backed onto the Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs. I vividly remember my first horseback ride through the Garden of the Gods, astride my newly acquired Emmy. Both of us were scared to death as we ventured for the first time into this enchanted world of red rock beauty. Initially, hundreds of acres officially bequeathed in 1909 by the family of Charles Perkins, who had previously let the public play on his private land, GOG, as locals lovingly refer to it, has grown to 1,367 acres over the many decades. In its wild expanse live dozens of species of birds, rattlesnakes, and all sorts of mammals, including bobcats and elk. I once witnessed a doe giving birth there. Perhaps polo horses were not the perfect fit to traverse the rocky terrain of the garden, and I have long since traded in the technical challenges of riding there for the more serene horseback experiences in beautiful Bear Creek Regional Park on Little Man, my gentle quarter horse. The horses and terrain might have changed over the years, but coming to life in Colorado has for me always meant a deepening love affair with riding. Much of what I love about my adopted state, I have experienced atop a horse. In fact, riding in Colorado inspired me to write the book People We Know, Horses They Love with Jill Rappaport. One of my favorite stories in the book is of Robert Wagner and Jill St. John, who were then living in both Aspen and Los Angeles with their horses, but now call the exclusive mountain community their full-time home. The diversity of experiences in the saddle is just one of the many multifaceted things about the Centennial State that attracted me. There are five main regions here: the Great Plains, the Southern Rocky Mountains, the Colorado Plateau, the Wyoming Basin, and the Middle Rocky Mountains. The state's 100,000-plus square miles boasts alpine mountains, high plains, deep canyons, and even deserts with towering sand dunes. It is the home of Pikes Peak and the Continental Divide, the Mesa Verde of ancestral Puebloans, and the mile-high city of modern urbanites. It has rivers named for their colors, white, blue, green, Colorado, the Spanish word for colored red. Their size, Grande, and their sound, Roaring Fork. Many of those places' names resound in history and sport. The Green River famously carried John Wesley Powell and his men on expeditions in 1869 and 1871. The clear waters of the powerful and fast-flowing Roaring Fork deliver legendary fly fishing and whitewater rafting. Rivers, mountains, plains, forests, deserts, the ever-changing, adventure-beckoning landscape has urged me to live in the outdoors as much as possible. From glimmering gold aspens in the fall to white blanketed peaks in the winter, Colorado's gorgeous scenery has been my companion along trails where I've witnessed, among other marvels, bighorn sheep muscling up mountainsides, solitary coyotes ranging their territory, and a mother bear and her two cubs peering down from a tree trunk not 10 feet above me. With 58 mountain peaks exceeding 14,000 feet, known as 14ers, more than any other state, it's a mecca for lovers of the outdoors who revel in the rugged beauty, the wildlife, and the active style. One of my best adventures took me 4 hours from home to another geothermally active spot, Steamboat Springs, in the Yampa Valley. About 20 miles out of town, I was immersed in pampered cowboy cool at the luxurious Middle Creek Ranch, dining on locally raised beef and homemade elk sausage, and helping the ranch manager cake the resident herd of 48 bison. There's nothing like a few days on a working spread to remind a Coloradan of the state's long history of ranching. But it was rumors of gold, not open ranch land, that changed the face of the place, surging the population of the region with untold numbers of westward-bound fortune seekers. And it was mining that became the state's most important industry in the 19th and early 20th centuries. It remains a significant force in the state today. The Pikes Peak Gold Rush kicked off in July 1858 and sent people stampeding. The changes that came with them remade the region politically, socially, and economically, and in February 1861 led to the creation of Colorado Territory. The influx culminated in statehood in 1876, 100 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, hence the nickname the Centennial State. Some of the old mining towns faded into ghost town obscurity, and their weathered remains dot the countryside to this day. Others survived and thrived as ski resorts, mountain towns, adventure destinations, and festival meccas. Durango, Breckenridge, and Silverton all began their lives as mining centers, towns that grew to support the railroads that penetrated the rugged Rockies to reach the rich mining areas have also transformed. Salida sprang up in 1880 after the Denver and Rio Grande, the D and RG, reached the area. It would become one of the most important railroad towns in the state. Now billed as the heart of the Rockies, it was a division point with the engine repair facilities, two roundhouses, and a huge three-rail yard for making up trains and transferring loads from narrow gauge to standard gauge rolling stock. By 1900, the mining boom was over, and Salida's transformation to a tourist destination was already underway. There were at least two passenger trains daily from Denver to Grand Junction, via Salida, and many more freights. An outfit called Around the Circle Tours advertised trips from Salida west to Durango and back around over Cumbres to Alamosa, over La Vida, and back to Denver. Its logo proclaimed scenic line of the world. Turn-of-the-century tourists to Salida would have found several hotels and boarding houses, an opera house where traveling theater groups regularly played, and a well-established red light district. Today, tourists find a picturesque art and adventure destination smack dab on the Arkansas River, a shoppers' and paddlers' paradise with a riverside promenade for walking, a canyon for whitewater rafting, a tramway for scenic gondola rides, and a historic downtown for exploring. With 136 preserved buildings dating from 1883 to 1910, Salida boasts Colorado's largest national historic district, now housing everything from art galleries and antique shops to distilleries and specialty stores. For all the wealth beneath the surface that propelled the state's growth, Colorado's allure lies above ground. The nickname Colorful Colorado, its purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain, described by Catherine Lee Bates when she wrote America the Beautiful, about a view from Pike's Peak during a trip to Colorado Springs in 1893, might well have also been inspired by dozens of lakes stocked with rainbow trout and with the changing colors of the seasons. Among the many colorful glories to behold here, Aspen Glow to Alpen Glow. As much as it's known for its outdoor attractions, Colorado has a great indoor scene too. Sophistication abounds in the state's Michelin-starred and James Beard Award-winning eateries. Home to some of the best restaurants in the West, it's a true foodie destination, and you could be happily sated even if you never ventured beyond Denver's famed food halls. The Buckhorn Exchange in Denver's oldest neighborhood might be the state's most historic, serving Western fare since 1893. But the Fort in Morrison, outside Denver, is certainly one of its most storied. Opened in 1963, it's known equally for its old-fashioned themed menu, featuring beef, game, and range-raised buffalo, and its imposing adobe building, based on the 1833 fur trapping post, Bent's Old Fort. There's no shortage of old-timey saloons here either. The oldest, the Buffalo Rose Saloon in Golden, got its start as a watering hole in 1859 during the gold era. For a good story along with a stiff drink, head up, literally elevation 10,151, to Leadville and the Silver Dollar Saloon. Established in 1879, it was once favored by Doc Holliday. There are plenty of celebrity haunts, too. One of my favorites is just blocks away from where I live. Older than the state itself, Manitou Springs, the Cliff House at Pike's Peak, was originally built in 1873 in true Victorian style, and over its almost 150 years, it has catered to the likes of Clark Gable and Buffalo Bill Cody, who have suites named after them. The Buffalo Bill boasts a teepee-style turret. Many contemporary celebrities visit the state, and many also either call Colorado home or have second homes here. One of Colorado's most famous transplants was Henry John Duchendorf, Jr. He loved the state so much, and happened to need something easier for headlining marquees, that he took its capital as its surname. It was Duchendorf, known the world over as John Denver, who in 1972 wrote Rocky Mountain High. The story goes that he was camping with wife Annie and friends around the tree line at 10,000 feet or so when he was inspired to pen the now-famous lyrics. After Denver's death, Colorado adopted Rocky Mountain High as its second official song. Denver adopted the state as his permanent home, living out his adult life in Aspen. They're in the heart of town next to the Roaring Fork River. You can find the John Denver Sanctuary and walk its scenic grounds amid perennial flowers and gray boulders engraved with his lyrics. In the summer, you can see performances by the local theater company, and year-round generally do what one of the inscriptions encourages: earth, water, mountain, sky, pause, reflect, enjoy. C&I favorites Kevin Costner and Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn own properties in upscale Aspen. When Russell starred in Quentin Tarantino's Western The Hateful Eight, he couldn't have been happier than that it was filmed in Telluride, just a 3-hour drive from his ranch. With all it's got going for it, it's no wonder that in 2019, USA Today declared Colorado the second best state in the country to live in. I talked to some of my favorite notable Coloradans to find out what they love about the state. Here are some conversations with prominent Coloradans about their favorite state. Robert Wagner. His friends call him J.R. Robert Wagner has enjoyed an acting career spanning some 70 years. Early on, Wagner appeared in the 1954 Western Broken Lance with Spencer Tracy and went on to make a name for himself on the big and small screens, including in the series Heart to Heart, most recently appearing as Anthony DiNozzo's father on NCIS for 9 years. He's been married for 31 years to wife and fellow actor Jill St. John. The couple have lived in Aspen for decades. What drew him to Colorado and Aspen? Well, obviously, Jill. But I first came to Colorado after the war in the late 40s, and more specifically to Aspen in 1949. I've always loved horses, wildlife, rivers, and streams. When I came here to go skiing with two French-Canadian ski instructors who stayed on here and made Aspen their home, Aspen was a much smaller and different place. When I wake up, I realize that I'm one of the most fortunate men in the world. First, I look over at Jill and then out across the Elton Mountains. Frequently, I'll see elk, fox, and deer, and feel so lucky to literally live in a forest. As Jill says, there are only so many front row seats, and we are fortunate to have one. Jill St. John. She heated up the big screen as Tiffany Case opposite Sean Connery's James Bond in 1971's Diamonds Are Forever, and went on to a decades-long film and television career, including appearing as herself in Robert Altman's Hollywood satirical comedy, The Player. She came to here in December 1959 with the man that I married several months later. I flew to Denver and drove to Aspen during a snowstorm. I woke up early and walked out to view this then small Victorian town full of empty lots and dogs running around, and soon had a little place outside of town. I was living in London making movies, but many years later was able to purchase 5.5 acres with a beautiful view, and that was it. I made my permanent move to Aspen in 1972. I really feel that being immersed in nature like this prolongs your life, and my goal was to be the oldest woman on the ski lift. But a bad skiing accident has unfortunately squashed that dream. In Colorado, you can also bike, hike, fish, and just look at nature around you, as well as experiencing all the culture that the area has to offer. Good cuisine has always been a large part of Aspen, Jill St. John says. Aquilina has wonderful authentic Italian food and is decorated with blown-up photos of Italian movie stars. One day, the owner said, "I'd love to put RJ's picture up there, but he'd have to be with an Italian." Wagner interrupting, "So I've brought in a picture of Sophia Loren and me." Rich Goose Gossage. Baseball's Hall of Fame pitcher Phenom and star relief pitcher for the New York Yankees, Goose Gossage, grew up in Colorado Springs, where he and his wife, Corna, have lived almost all their lives. In his prime, his pitches flew at more than 100 miles an hour. After pitching in 3 World Series, he retired from the game but remains active in youth sports in his hometown, where the Rick Goose Gossage Youth Sports Complex accommodates baseball, softball, skateboarding, BMX, hiking, and biking. I love all the seasons, especially the fall. Summers are so short here, you blink and you miss them. The changing of the leaves is the most beautiful time, especially when the aspen turn from green to yellow, then gold, and the oak brush turns from yellow to a very deep copper. It's such a fabulous time, but the only bad thing about it is that winter is coming. I spent 4 years in San Diego playing for the Padres, but we always knew we would move back to Colorado. My family didn't have 2 nickels to rub together when I was growing up. I was the youngest of 8 kids, but living in the beautiful and rugged Colorado mountains gave me a sense of place. My father lived like a mountain man. When I was a boy, the outside was my playground, and now hiking and fishing are truly in my DNA. I love Bonnie and Reed in downtown Colorado Springs as my favorite restaurant, especially the oysters. Before COVID, my wife and I would eat there a couple of times a week. Good seafood is hard to get here in Colorado, and Bonnie and Reed have the best in the area. We also like the famous steakhouse for great steaks and Jake and Telly's Greek Tavern for Greek food. Carrie Whitman. Colorado-born celebrity interior designer Carrie Whitman founded her eponymous interiors company in 1994. Dividing her time between Los Angeles and Boulder, she works with high-profile clients such as Jessica Alba, Antonio Banderas, and Melanie Griffith. Her passion is high-end residential design, which she showcases in unique homes throughout Colorado and the world. Why she moved from L.A. back to Boulder? I was raised in Boulder and then moved to New York, thinking that I wanted to move away from Colorado, and of course, years later realized how wonderful Colorado really is. Ending up in L.A. for a few years, I dabbled in acting and modeling, but I soon realized that acting wasn't my calling. I had always loved design, and I'd taken drafting in high school. When my focus became design, Emilio Estevez was my first client. 4 years ago, I opened my office in Boulder and felt like I was going home. Now I divide my time between California and Colorado. What makes Colorado so special? Oh, there is so much. There is an energy in Colorado that I have never felt anywhere else that is caused by the bright sun and the quiet snow and even the flow of the mountains. I am around people who love their neighbors, and there is a feeling of freedom here. When I get to Boulder, I never really want to leave. Does Colorado and Boulder inspire your unique sense of design? Oh, yes, the state and the town inspire me 1,000%. Nature is my muse. One quick example, I was looking in my front yard and pulled a piece of bark off of a tree and created a color palette from its green and corals for a house that I'm designing in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. John Fielder. Perhaps Colorado's most prominent nature photographer, John Fielder has published 50-plus books in 40-plus years. In 2020, he published the best-selling book, Colorado's Highest, The History of Naming the 14,000-Foot Peaks. This fall, he's coming out with a new book on the state, Weld Country, 4,000 Square Miles of Grandeur, Greatness, and Yesterdays. Available for pre-order on johnfielder.com. I love to share Colorado through photography and a few well-chosen words when appropriate. My skills come from a strong pair of legs that can take me most any place, and my eye as a photographer capturing Colorado nature. I've lived in the state for more than 40 years. I love sharing with my readers the sublimeness that is Colorado. I believe the state is the most beautiful place on earth. I spent 4 years exploring the Great Plains of Eastern Colorado for publication this September of an extraordinary book about Colorado's third largest county, Weld. It includes 175 images of farms and ranches, the Poudre, Platte, and St. Vrain rivers, the grasslands and Pawnee Buttes, old towns and buildings, and wildlife galore. Even then and now, photographs of historical Weld County. Weld's de facto official historian, Peggy Ford Waldo, has written text to connect the dots from the county's creation in 1861 to what has become Colorado's fastest-growing major county, yet still a place defined by its remoteness. I remember standing in Rocky Mountain National State Park with my middle school science class looking at beauty. Although I've traveled around the world, when I come back, no matter what wonders I have seen, I always say, I like Colorado better. Stephen Weaver. Stephen Weaver was formerly educated as a geologist and continues to work as a geology instructor. But he's also a photographer who shoots award-winning images of the natural world. He's a member of the Ranchlands group of artists, which meets every year at visually inspiring places like Zapata Ranch and Chico Basin Ranch to create pieces for a fall art show. Geology actually brought me to Colorado initially. I attended the Colorado School of Mines, where I received my Ph.D. Then I moved to Wisconsin, where I taught for several years. And then I moved back to Colorado to teach geology at Colorado College. I love both working with students in the lab as well as photographing the vast outdoor areas of the state. What's a perfect day in the Centennial State? For me, it's an hour before sunrise and an hour after sunset, when I'm out in either the prairies or the mountains and I have scoped out an area for a beautiful photographic scene. I may go to Lost Lake in the Crested Butte area, where I can capture the clouds above the horizon that are reflected in the lake. A perfect day is when I can extract art from nature that tells the viewer a story about the environment. As both an artist and a scientist, I try to understand the science of geology and nature, as well as being an artist capturing what is beautiful. Leah Davis Witherow, the curator of history at the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum, Leah Davis Witherow was selected as a Woman of Influence in 2018 by Colorado Springs Business Journal. Little known secrets about the Front Range. A place that has real meaning for me and seems like such a great getaway is Rock Ledge Ranch Historic Site, a living history museum. When you're on the grounds, nestled in the southeastern end of the Garden of the Gods, you feel a world away from Colorado Springs. Facing west, all you see are foothills, mountains, and blue skies above. It almost feels like a step back in time. One of the things that I really appreciate is that the interpreters present inclusive history. There is an American Indian interpretive area, the blacksmith shop, the historic Rock Ledge House, and the 1900 Orchard House. Hundreds of years of continuous history in one location. It literally takes your breath away. I absolutely love spring and everything that it represents. I love to walk through the new grass, start to work in my garden, and feel the sun on my face. Spring gives me a sense of hope, renewal, and positivity, and we have months and months before winter arrives again. Cody Lustro. Colorado native and a former professional rodeo cowboy who specialized in bull riding, Cody Lostro was the 2009 Professional Bull Riders World Champion and consecutive 10-time qualifier for the PBR World Finals. He lives with his wife Candace in the small town of Alt. I've lived here all my life and know and love everything about the state. Good people and good country. There is so much to do and experience here. We've lived in the area for 8 years, and here at the ranch we raise bucking bulls and 60 to 80 head of cattle, as well as several horses. In the winter, I'm a hunter's guide. My favorite season, well, we can experience all the seasons in one day here, but I really like early spring in Colorado. The weather starts to get nice, and the fields are starting to green up.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading articles from True West, June 2021 edition. History, Haunts, and Hotels. Old West adventures await across the cowboy state's colorful Carbon County. Quite likely the most gruesome artifact on exhibit in any museum in Wyoming, maybe the West, is the pair of shoes at the Carbon County Museum in Rawlins. They might appear to be just simple leather shoes, and they are, except that the leather is the skin of Big Nose George Parrott. The skinning came after the hanging from a telegraph pole in front of the Hughes store on Front Street in Rawlins, and that happened after Parrott hit Sheriff James G. Rankin over the head with a pair of shackles and then escaped from the county jail. It all started in 1878 when Parrott, Dutch Charlie Burris, and some accomplices attempted to derail a Union Pacific train near the coal mining town of Carbon. They weren't successful, but the effort earned the attention of Carbon County deputy sheriffs Tip Vincent and Robert Widowfield, who pursued the outlaws right into an ambush on the west side of Elk Mountain. Vincent and Widowfield were the first two lawmen to die in the line of duty in Wyoming Territory, and after their killing, Parrott and Burris struck out north to hole-in-the-wall country and eventually to Montana, where they were arrested 2 years later. Brought back to Carbon County, Burris was dragged off a train near Carbon and hanged. Parrott went to trial and was sentenced to death, but he escaped before his execution date. He was quickly recaptured and hanged and then skinned by the doctor who did the autopsy on his body. There is more to this story that you can learn at the Carbon County Museum. Parrott was not the only outlaw to ride through Carbon County. Butch Cassidy and the Wild Bunch frequented Little Snake River Valley, which was isolated and, more importantly, strategically located between Hole in the Wall and Brown's Park, both regular hangouts for the gang. The Gaddis Matthews House in Bags is a tangible reminder of the connections Cassidy and the Wild Bunch had to the area. Little Snake River. The oldest building at the Little Snake River Museum in Savory is a two-story, hand-hewn log cabin built in 1873 by Jim Baker, an old mountain man with ties to the Shoshone tribe. The museum opened a new sheep industry exhibit in 2020 and has a number of other historic structures from ranches and homesteads. The museum holds regular history programs and annually hosts a trek to local historic sites. Kit Carson and John C. Fremont crossed the Sierra Madre between Savory and Encampment in 1843, and this region was filled with workers from 1896 to 1908, when the Grand Encampment Copper District swelled following the discovery of copper ore by Ed Haggerty, a sheep herder and prospector. Original buildings and artifacts from the mining camps, tight camps, and the town of Grand Encampment and surrounding communities, many of them now ghost towns, are the foundation of the Grand Encampment Museum that has a one-room school, a two-story outhouse, and a forest fire lookout tower. This year, the museum hosts Bob Bozbell in his True West History Symposium, June 11th and 12th. Other speakers include Johnny D. Boggs, Linda Womack, and David Heska, Wambly Whedon. Saratoga's Hot Springs. Originally known as Warm Springs, Saratoga became a neutral area for tribes in the 19th century as they came to the area to soak in the natural hot mineral springs. Visitors still have a chance to enjoy the hot pools at the Free Hobo Pool, located so close to the North Platte River that some who soak take the plunge into the cold river water as part of their treatment, just like the Indians used to do. Another hot spring soak is possible at the Saratoga Inn Resort in its medium-sized swimming pool and smaller soaking pools sheltered by Indian teepees. The Wolf Hotel in downtown Saratoga is a rare gem. It once changed ownership in a poker game, but the Campbell family bought it decades ago and restored it to Victorian grandeur. The rooms are uniquely decorated. One is now named for Joe Pickett, the Wyoming game warden, created by local author C.J. Box. The bar is small and inviting, and the dining is among the best in the county. Elk Mountain. The killing of Tip Vincent and Robert Widowfield by Big Nose George Parrott and his associates took place on the west side of Elk Mountain. It took a sheriff's search party 9 days to find the two lawmen. Traveling today from Saratoga to Elk Mountain, take the Rattlesnake Pass Road, which passes through the county where the lawmen met their end. This route was used by Cherokee Indians traveling to California after 1850, and it became a part of the Overland Trail. In 1862, the 11th Ohio Volunteer Cavalry established Fort Halleck, named for Major General Henry W. Halleck, as one of a series of forts and stations situated to protect the Overland Trail, which had replaced the more northerly Oregon-California trails as the major route linking east to west. Jack Slade worked for a time at Fort Halleck as the superintendent of the Overland Stage Line. The fort on the north side foothills of Elk Mountain was a tough assignment in winter due to deep snow and sometimes brutal winds. While Elk Mountain is a very small town today, it has an excellent historic property, the Elk Mountain Hotel, where you'll find a quiet room and a good meal. This town has ranch roots, but the nearby ghost town of Carbon was a mining and railroad town, the first coal town established on the Union Pacific Line in Wyoming. One early history says in 1869, the houses sprang up as from the earth itself, as miners dug caves into the side of the nearby ravine and covered the fronts with board and earth, with a stovepipe poked through the hole in the top of each roof. More substantial homes and businesses quickly followed, and the Black Diamond newspaper dished the news of the camp. Miners flocked to the region to dig coal, producing an estimated 4.7 tons from 1868 to 1902. There are multiple factors for the demise of Carbon. A cholera epidemic devastated many families, but the decision by the Union Pacific to move its main line farther north was the final blow. The new tracks spawned the coal mining town of Hanna, and most people in Carbon moved there. They even took some of the buildings with them. The Hanna Basin Museum interprets the area's coal mining history, especially the tragic 1903 mine explosion that killed 171 miners. Medicine Bow. When Owen Wister visited Medicine Bow in 1885, he wrote in his journal a passage that later appeared almost verbatim in his classic novel, The Virginian. This place is called a town, Medicine Bow, Wyoming. Consists of one depot house and baggage room, one coal chuter, one water tank, one store, two eating houses, one billiard hall, six shanties, eight gents and ladies' walks, two tool houses, one feed stable, five too late for classification, 29 buildings in all. When you visit today, you'll see that the Bow is little changed. Wister also said Medicine Bow appeared to be strewn there by the wind. Yep. That still fits, so hold on to your hat. Walking in the Virginian Hotel is like stepping back in time. The bar is almost a history exhibit with its collection of rodeo, ranching, cowboy, and other historic photos on the walls, including a large original print of the Vern Wood photograph of the famous wild horse Desert Dust. A lunch counter and eating area with big booths are casual, but the Owen Wister dining room is elegantly decorated in rich red with white linen, crystal and silver decor. The rooms in the main hotel include the Owen Wister suite. Union Pacific trains rumble routinely through the town. The tracks are across the street, U.S. Highway 30, from the Virginian. The former Union Pacific Depot has been converted into the town's museum, which also has a up caboose and the small Owen Wister cabin. A wide spot in the road. Fort Steele State Historic Site. In 1879, when the Ute Indians revolted against the Indian Agency managed by Nathan Meeker in northwest Colorado, perpetrating what became known as the Meeker Massacre, soldiers under the command of Major Thomas Thornburg rode from their post at Fort Steele to provide relief to the agency. Those troops encountered angry Utes and were themselves attacked in a battle that became a siege. Fort Steele was located adjacent to the North Platte River on a 36-square-mile military reservation, with most buildings constructed of logs hauled in from Elk Mountain or floated down the North Platte River from camps in the Sierra Madre. Fort Steele had adequate quarters for five companies of soldiers. Buildings included a library, storehouse for the quartermaster and commissary, stables, shops for carpenters, a blacksmith, bakery, a granary, and an area for laundresses. Once the Union Pacific Railroad was in place, the fort was a strategic supply location. Foundations and crumbling ruins of some of the buildings remain at the State Historic Site, located just off Interstate 80, east of Sinclair. True West, June 2021 edition. Searching for Wyatt Earp as a Boy by Jana Bommersback. The Pella Historical Society starts at home. Certainly, Wyatt Earp didn't play cowboys and Indians growing up in Pella, Iowa. We know because it would be decades before cowboys were glorified enough for little boys to imitate, and Indians were still too real and seen as too dangerous. But this is all about that certain for the years when Wyatt was a lad. Few shreds of information exist. Maybe he pitched marbles like other boys. Perhaps played hide and seek. Probably had a slingshot. Maybe staged shoot-em-up matches with his brothers or neighbor boys. We know he and his brothers got into fights with the Dutch boys whose families founded Pella. In one, a Gas brother took off his wooden shoe and bonked one of the Earp brothers. No report on the outcome, but it's likely Nicholas gave his boys the win, since he bragged how proud he was that he had taught them all to fight. We know Wyatt loved horses, again from his father's tutelage. We have evidence he adored Mother Earp. Everyone knows he admired his older brothers and was in charge of the two younger ones, Morgan and Warren, born in Pella. Did he cry when one sister and then another died? Did he tend the boiling water for the birth of his baby sister, Adelia, who'd be the only one with him all of his life? Did he go to school in Pella, a school that taught in both Dutch and English? And if he did, what kind of student was he? He had to have gone to school somewhere, since he could read and write, and he couldn't have learned it from home because his mother, Virginia Ann, was illiterate. We know mother taught him manners, and father showed all his sons that a living could be made in law enforcement. Nicholas Earp was proud that most of his boys were chips off the old block. The only other certainty about young Wyatt is that he couldn't have guessed the life he'd lead, that he'd have 80 years and become the last surviving Western legend. Imagine if he knew he'd be the only one unscathed in the most famous gunfight of the Old West near the OK Corral in Tombstone. That his lifelong titles included Frontier Lawman, prospector, gambler, saloon keeper, boxing referee, pimp, horse thief, and avenging murderer. That he'd swear off whiskey after his first drunk. That he'd be considered the cool head of the Earp Boys. That he'd outlive all his brothers. From the most popular Virgil to the most tragic Warren. That he'd love three women, marrying only once, but becoming a widower who buried a wife and unborn child before their first anniversary. Then hooking up with the woman he had abandoned in Tombstone as her addiction took over their lives, and finally spending half his life with a woman who had tried to glamorize his exploits and has mucked up the real story to this day. That he had never had children. That he'd be remembered as a generous man who loved giving gifts and was devoted to reading. That dozens of books, TV shows, and movies would be made about him, and his name would come to mean Old West all by itself. He'd have probably laughed if he knew that when he died in Los Angeles on January 13, 1929, the Los Angeles Examiner would write, "He was 80 when death knocked. It found the old Lion of Tombstone as ever ready." They were what might be called old acquaintances, having played hide and seek with one another all over the West for nearly 60 years. No, his days in Iowa were the days of a little boy, then a teen, who probably marked only Christmas and his birthday on March 19th. The rainy day he was born in 1848, his father gave him the full name of his commanding officer from the Mexican War, Wyatt Barry Stapp Earp. All that name came to mean was still far, far away. But then so were the names Wichita and Dodge City and Tombstone, none of which existed in these years when Wyatt Earp was growing up. The Earps of Pella. Wyatt Earp was 2 years old when his father brought the family to Pella in 1850. Big brother James was 9, Virgil was 7, and sister Martha was 5. Mother Virginia Ann gave birth to Morgan in 1851 and Warren in 1855. The family would tragically lose Martha in 1856. The 1850 census lists Nicholas P. Earp as a copper and a farmer. But he first supported the family as a steamboat captain for the Des Moines Steamboat Company. Starting in 1852, he bought a considerable amount of farmland northeast of Pella. One purchase included a set of house logs, shingles, lumber, rails, as well as logs still at the mill, according to local archives. There's no evidence he used the material to build a home, but it's easy to surmise he had to, since the family was out there on the land and had to live somewhere. Wyatt spent 4 years on that farm, near a town that eventually called itself A Touch of Holland on the Prairie. Pella was founded in 1847 by 800 immigrants fleeing religious persecution from the Netherlands, people wealthy enough to purchase the land and build a town with the motto, "In God Our Hope and Refuge." Only later generations could afford the tulips from the homeland that now give the town an annual Tulip Time festival in May. The Earps left in 1854, moving back to their previous abode in Monmouth, Illinois, where they stayed for 6 years. Nicholas was busy politically, peeling off Democrats who were also anti-slavery to form a new political party known as Republicans. He was one of the organizers of a debate in the town square for the Illinois Senate candidates Stephen A. Douglas and Abraham Lincoln. Democrat Douglas won the Senate race, but eventually lost to Lincoln in 1860, the first Republican candidate for president. The Earp family also grew, with the birth of Virginia Ann in 1858. In 1859, Nicholas moved his family back to Pella, and eventually settled into a downtown row house. Wyatt was now 11. They stayed 5 years, until Nicholas led a wagon train to California in 1864 with three other Pella families. There is no record of Wyatt Earp mentioning any of his two stints in this town, where workers wore wooden shoes and Dutch-born women still preferred long skirts, lace caps, and aprons. That doesn't mean Pella is mute about the Earps, at least not anymore. For years, people didn't want to talk about the Earps living here, says Valerie Van Kooten, executive director of the Pella Historical Society and Museums. They felt it was not a good role model. 5 years ago, the house was in such bad shape, some said we should tear it down. But I thought we were sitting on a gold mine. We're the only ones who can tell the story of Wyatt from age 2 to 16, and we should tell it the best way we can. The Society has been hard at work on the project ever since, and now can proudly say it has not only totally restored the row house to its 1800s glory, but has created new multimedia exhibits to capture the entire life of Wyatt Earp. Archivist Lois Smith notes it includes Pella during the Earp years, the Earp brothers in the Civil War, the three women in Wyatt's life, the legend that grew around him, the wagon train trip to California when Wyatt was 16, and Wyatt as an old man. The Earp family lived in the first floor apartment of a row house built by Van Spakeren Brothers on Franklin Street, near the center of town, from 1861 to 1864. This is where, in 1861, Adelia was born in June, and three-year-old Virginia died in October, while their father was an alderman on the Pella City Council. Nicholas was appointed town marshal in 1862, serving until he left with the wagon train. The house, done in 18th-century Dutch style of architecture, is an unusual look for the Midwest, and now is on the National Register of Historic Preservation. In 1966, it became the first official office of the Pella Historical Society, and a small Earp Museum was started as part of the historical village. But there's nothing small about the new museum, which officially opened in early May during the town's annual Tulip Time Festival. Some Earp descendants surely attended, including Van Kooten's daughter-in-law, who is related by marriage to the Lorenzo Earp side of the family that still lives in the Pella area. Archivist Smith also agonizes that few records exist about young Wyatt, but says if he went to school here, he'd only have had a couple of blocks walk to the town's first brick, two-story park school. She suspects he enjoyed the traditional 4th of July celebrations that were popular throughout the nation. But records do tell of Wyatt's thirst to fight in the Civil War. His older brothers all went off to fight on the Union side, including Nicholas's son from an earlier marriage, Newton. Wyatt watched as 13-year-old Tommy Copps of Pella joined up as a drummer boy and decided he could go too. After all, he was 25 days into his 13th year when war broke out, but his father and mother declared he was too young to go, and even though Wyatt ran away to join up a couple of times, his father always apprehended him and brought him home. Nicholas put Wyatt in charge of one of the farms, expecting him to get help from younger Morgan and Warren. Wyatt learned he wasn't a farmer. It paled in comparison to the action he imagined his brothers facing. But in the end, he stayed put, because the strongest tie was to family. And it was these years, mainly in Pella, that family became defined in the heart and soul of Wyatt Earp. It would be nice to know more about his life in those years. The few shreds we have seem too pitiful, considering the volumes we have about his life after these years. But thanks to the Pella Historical Society, the story we can piece together is being told. Jana Bommersbach has earned recognition as Arizona's Journalist of the Year and won an Emmy and two Lifetime Achievement Awards. She co-wrote the Emmy-winning Outrageous Arizona and has written three true crime books, a children's book, and the historical novel Cattle Kate. He was an incurable charlatan. He was years ahead of his peers when it came to harassing the Salt and Gila Rivers and might have become rich and famous instead of infamous, but he turned everything into a con or scheme. How did wranglers herd the horses on cattle drives? Sylvia Weatherford, Long Beach, California. The wrangler on a trail drive was usually the youngest and least experienced of the hands, but his job was a serious one. He took care of the remuda, the horses that kept the drovers mounted. On the long drive, a wrangler was almost as important as the chuckwagon cook. Especially important, making sure they grazed as much as possible. Each cowboy had 6 to 10 horses for his string, and he rotated them regularly. It was important that the animals were healthy and strong over the 6 to 8 weeks on the trail, so the wrangler had to know every horse in the remuda, some 60 to 100 head. In the morning, he checked the remuda to see if any had strayed during the night. If any had, he would hunt for the missing horses while the rest grazed. He was expected to have every horse accounted for at noon camp, where the cowboys would change mounts. There were no pens, so after the horses were gathered, the drovers made a circle with ropes. When a horse was being broken, it was trained to respect a single strand of rope. A big remuda would stay inside this temporary fence. When did the mercantile stores stop selling dynamite? Chris Pepple, Morongo Valley, California. It wasn't too long ago. The early hardwood stores did sell dynamite to individuals. You had to complete some paperwork, and the law stated you had to detonate it the same day you purchased it. It was illegal to store it, as it could become dangerous. The law regarding the sale of dynamite was changed in 1975. There were more restrictions after Oklahoma City and 9/11. What was the pay for a wagon master? Thomas Vallis, Beechwood, New Jersey. The wagon master generally earned $125 a month, and he earned it. His responsibilities began long before his train set out. He chose his bullwhackers, oversaw the training of the unbroken animals, and the loading of the wagons. On the trail, he had to be forceful enough to impose his authority on rough and tough men. He regularly patrolled his train and reiterated ahead of the lookout for hostile Indians and difficult stretches of the road. He chose routes, timed the march, and decided where to camp. When the water ran high at river crossings, when the wagons mired down, it was he who made the decisions and gave the orders. Did John Slaughter and Wyatt Earp ever meet? Mark Schoenfield, Wilmette, Illinois. I scoured the Wyatt Earp section of my library, which includes books by Casey Tieferteller, Gary Roberts, John Bossenecker, Chuck Horung, Jeff Gwynn, Alan Barra, Karen Holiday Tanner, Steve Gatto, Don Chaput, Ben Trawick, and Jack Burroughs. There seems to be no mention of Wyatt and John Slaughter ever meeting, or if they did, it would have been casual. They didn't have much in common. Earp was a Northern Republican, and Slaughter was a Texas rebel.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.